ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cara, acne can be tough. Whether your kid is just starting to get breakouts or has been struggling with them for years, there's a great product that can help.
Phyla is the ultimate game changer. It tackles acne right at its root cause, rebalancing the skin's bacteria and packing it with probiotic phages.
Phyla harnesses the superpowers of probiotics, tiny warriors targeting and wiping out the acne-causing bacteria. In studies, Phyla slashed acne-causing bacteria by a whopping 90%.
Phyla doesn't just fix acne you can see. It stops new breakouts in their tracks. It has no harsh chemicals and won't irritate or dry most skin. Phyla's three-step system is like a dermatologist-approved magic potion. Cleanse, apply serum, and moisturize twice a day.
As a special treat for our listeners, you can grab 25% off your first order of Phyla. Head over to phylabiotics.com, enter code PUBERTY at checkout, and kickstart your family's journey to acne-free skin. Check out the link in our show notes for quick access.
Hi, I'm Cara Natterson.
And I'm Vanessa Kroll Bennett.
And we are obsessed with flipping puberty positive.
Puberty is a stage of life best described as a roller coaster of physical and emotional shifts. It happens to literally every human being on earth. And it shouldn't be cringy. It should feel, you know, pretty comfortable.
Which is why we started this podcast and a newsletter, and why we film slightly ridiculous but informative social media videos.
It's why we have a brand that makes clothes that literally feel so comfortable, and why we write books too. Our latest is This Is So Awkward, Modern Puberty Explained.
We have built a universe of puberty positivity, and it all started with this podcast.
We are so happy that you're here.
Vanessa, what an interesting conversation our listeners are about to hear. I mean, anyone who has any questions about the college process, we have had a couple of podcasts on the topic. We now have Jeff Salingo, who, among other things, actually embedded with college admissions teams at three different colleges across the country in 2018. And he learned firsthand how they make the choices that they make about admissions. So he really got under the process in a way that I don't know anyone has done that and published about it.
Yeah, I mean, his book, Who Gets In and Why, is really true journalism about the college admissions process and understanding how the process has changed, what those drivers are. And Jeff's been reporting on higher education for more than two decades. He's a New York Times bestselling author of three books, contributes to The Atlantic, and his pieces in The Atlantic and elsewhere are really, really seminal pieces about the college process. And part of our reason for having him on is not just for those of you going through the process or going through the process in a year, but for those of you who have younger kids, this is an opportunity to kind of rethink your whole attitude about the college process and use his information and his insights to kind of frame this journey with your kids through middle school and high school in maybe a more open-minded way so that it helps your kid and your whole family approach it in a healthy way and make things maybe a little bit easier on you all. So enjoy, and we know it will be an edifying conversation for everybody.
Hi, Jeff. We're so happy to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, you ready to jump in? We're going to start broad.
Okay, go right ahead.
What is the most broken part of the college process?
Oh, geez, the whole thing. I don't even know where to start that question. But it starts, you know, the college admissions is the front door of higher education. And when you look at every poll today on higher education, America's faith in its colleges and universities, which has always been a bedrock of America, is at its lowest point than ever. And it's, by the way, bipartisan. Both the right and the left do not like higher education, right? They think it's too expensive, it's not getting kids jobs, it's not teaching them the right skills, it's brainwashing them, whatever. But it all starts at the front door, which is college admissions, which that system, more than anything, I think is broken. And I keep telling college leaders this, you have to fix that to get people to respect higher education again. Because if you look at any, you know, parent group on Facebook, or you talk to parents and counselors, everybody's talking about their seniors and the family and the stresses they're going through with the college application process. And I shouldn't say it just starts with seniors. It starts even earlier in high school with taking the right courses and the SATs and ACTs and test optional and all this other stuff. It's crazier than it ever has been. And I thought, when I wrote this book in 2018, 2019, that it was pretty crazy then. And then it just got crazier during the pandemic.
You thought you were at peak crazy?
Yes.
There's always room for more.
Every year it gets worse. There's always room for more. And if you just think about the numbers, back in 2002 or something like that, there were 4 million college applications filed. So maybe the high school graduating class around then was around 2 million or so. So say two applications per, you know, every student. And not everybody, of course, goes to college. Now, last year, there were something like 11, 12 million applications filed, and about the same size high school graduating class. So this idea that students are applying to 10, 12, 14 schools, like if anybody came from another planet and saw how we apply to college, they'd be like, seriously, this is how you do it in 2024? You haven't come up with a more efficient system?
So, Jeff, I want to touch on that comment of how early things start, because I would actually argue it starts well before high school. I live in New York City, Cara lives in LA, you live in DC. One might argue that the kindergarten admissions process, right? The preschool admissions, the TWOS program admissions process is both influenced by and influences this college admissions process, which is just positively insane. And I do not use the word insane lightly. It is troubling and it is not good. So we have listeners. So just so you know, we don't just have folks with high school kids or even just middle school kids. We have people with, you know, 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, all the way on up. I know you talked about the progression in the pandemic and after the pandemic, but there's an explosion of change in the college admissions process just in recent years. How did we get to where we are? And you can just pick a couple of things, like maybe talk a little bit about the Common App, maybe talk a little bit about the cost of college, but how did we get to this bananas scenario? And then we're going to like tease out some very specific topics.
Yeah, so I think there are three things that really led us to where we are today. One is, as I outlined in the book, the concept of distance for college has really changed. Like when I graduated high school in 1991, if you went like a couple states away, that was going really far away. And I even remember my sister who went to college in the 80s, right? And she would have to call home from the payphone in the hallway of her dormitory after 10 o'clock at night, because that's when long distance rates went down. Well, now the concept of going, you know, all the way across the country is not that big of a deal. You could jump on a Southwest flight. Your kids are literally like a text or a FaceTime away from you. So it's like you're going next door to go to college. And so how has that impacted things? Well, now colleges that used to be much more regional are much more national and international. And so you have these students just jumping into the same applicant pools at the same universities all across the world. So the numbers just went way up because of that. Second is the Common App, right? So the Common App was around since the 70s. It was always pretty popular, even in the 80s and 90s, but then it took off with the introduction of the internet. And then now 1,000+ colleges on it, which makes it so easy to apply to multiple colleges at once. Because I know when I applied to college, I was typing on an old Smith Corona typewriter there, and I got kind of tired after three or four, right? So, but now it, you know, it's literally push a button. And then the other thing is that, at least in the parents that I'm talking to for this most recent book, I'm just amazed at the communities that I'm in, the concern, the worry about their kids in a way that I'm sure my parents were worried about me, but that they're really worried about that they're going to launch into life and have a good career and a good life. And we seem to think that the only way they get that is through an admission ticket to a very selective college. And that's not true, by the way. It's a myth that I try to bust. And that's why I think this starts all the way down at age three or four or five, because you feel like, well, I have to get into the right school to get into the right high school, to get into the right college, or I have to take the right curriculum. I was at a school, K through 12 school last week speaking, and everybody was talking about the math curriculum in middle school and how that leads to certain classes in high school, because that's how you get into computer science and engineering in college and going to the right college to get the right job. I mean, it's kind of bananas when you think about, like, we're thinking about what our kids are going to do when they're like 5, 6, 10, 11, 12, right? I'm 51 and I still don't know what I really want to do.
Come sit by us. I mean, first of all, I just want to plug the book for a second, because I think it's not just incredibly well written, but it is your cred. So you embedded with three different schools over the course of a year to watch their admissions processes, three totally different schools, different sizes, different, everything about them was different. You also follow specific kids through their process, not necessarily their process through these exact same schools. So there's a snippet of that. You have also been writing in this space for a very, very, very long time. So this is not you kind of falling into this area saying, oh, I'm sort of interested in college. You have very much lived and breathed this for years. And then you went and got very deep. And there's a lot to be said for every element of what you just described that's written about in the book. I'd love to go into the Common App for 1 second and just ask about the ease versus complexity, I would say, of the Common App. Having two kids recently go through the process of the Common App, one thing that I was struck by is the degree of executive function that is required to complete the Common App, because I did my applications like you did yours on a typewriter. The Common App, while yes, it's very easy to check a box, it is the most complicated document with tabs within tabs within tabs. And I was not a participant, really. I was just an occasional observer. I was floored by what kids are being asked to do. And it felt to me like yet another example of an unlevel playing field that for, and you write about this a lot in many different ways, but for kids who don't have the support and who don't have the adults around them telling them how to do things or how to stay organized or what they might put where, it's not that easy to use the Common App.
No. And in some ways, colleges have added, you know, supplemental questions and essays because they do want to have a little bit of a bar for students to get over. So it's not just as easy as pushing a button. I just reported a story for New York Magazine about this admissions season. And one of the questions that I asked of the folks of the Common App is, well, what if you just reduce the number of colleges that you can apply to from 20 to 10, for example, or put other limits on it? And their retort is that, well, if we limit it, someone else will just come in and meet that demand, right? In fact, something like 90% of Common App members have other ways of applying. Mm-hmm. And so the Common App says, if we go away, students will just find another way to apply. In other words, we're not the problem, you are, type of thing, right? And maybe that's true, because I think what's happening now is that students get into an environment, whether that's school or community or with friends, and they see all these other kids applying to multiple schools and they think they need to apply to more. And we've created this early admission season now, which is really new in a lot of ways between early action and early decision. And you see all these other kids applying early, so you feel like you have to apply early. And oh, by the way, you're not getting the answers you want, so you have to put out even more applications during regular decision. And so it is the application, I think, part of it. But part of it is also just the conversations that we're all having in our communities, among parents at Starbucks, among students in their schools, that is creating kind of this really vicious cycle that every year seems to get worse.
Vanessa, we literally have 3 minutes to eat lunch every day. I am not joking. And the challenge is how to make it delicious and healthy and still fit into that tiny window. Our answer is Factor's ready-to-eat meals. They have been a godsend.
We throw our Factor meals in the microwave. It takes 2 minutes and out comes a gorgeous, fresh, never frozen meal. We both love the tamale vegetarian one. It's delish. There's a ton of options every week. There's 60 add-ons, breakfast, snacks, beverages. I love doing the wellness shots with my kids. They think it's hilarious, and I know they're getting vitamins and minerals in their bodies.
So get meals on your table or at your desk in 2 minutes or less. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning. You can customize with flexibility to get as much or as little as you need, and you can press pause or reschedule depending upon your lifestyle.
So to order, go to factormeals.com/puberty50 and use the code puberty50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That code is puberty50 at factormeals.com/puberty50 to get 50% off your first box, 20% off your next box. And I am going to go do that right now because I need more Factor meals in my refrigerator. Cara, lately I have been lying awake at night. I'm physically exhausted, but I can't sleep because my mind is so wired with everything going on between work and my family. So I've added Magnesium Breakthrough to my nightly routine, and it actually helps calm my mind. It helps me get better sleep, and I wake up feeling better rested. I'm less cranky, and I'm more patient with my family and with you.
Oh, I've noticed. And it's because, unlike other magnesium supplements that might give one or two formulations of magnesium, Magnesium Breakthrough has 7. That's why you're sleeping so well and waking up refreshed. Now, dietary supplementation is always best, Vanessa. So that means eating your minerals and vitamins is the best way to get them in. But if you can't or you don't get enough, Magnesium Breakthrough is the way to go. It can also help digestion, though too much helps your digestion too much, which is not a good thing. It can support muscle recovery, so bye-bye, Charlie horses. And it helps build dense bones, which is especially important for women approaching and in menopause.
We have an exclusive offer for our listeners. You can go to buyoptimizers.com/puberty, buyoptimizers.com/puberty. And you can use the code PUBERTY10 during checkout to save 10%. That promo code is PUBERTY10 at buyoptimizers.com/puberty. Your body and brain and family and business partner will thank you.
Cara, my kids love Magic Spoon cereal. And even though it's cereal, they actually love it as a homework snack. The variety pack has 4 flavors, cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. And fruity is the favorite flavor in my house.
Now, this pack has 0 grams of sugar, between 13 and 14 grams of protein, and between 4 and 5 grams of net carbs per serving. It's made with wholesome ingredients, no artificial flavors or dyes, and it's high in protein, gluten-free, grain-free, and soy-free. So a great choice, Vanessa.
You can go to magicspoon.com/puberty to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our, you guessed it, promo code puberty at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident you're going to love their product. It's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they will refund your money. No questions asked. They do not want you to send their cereal back to them.
Try a bowl of Magic Spoon cereal today at magicspoon.com/puberty and use the code puberty to save $5.
Jeff, can you talk about the explosion of the early action, early decision reality and kind of share how that's really changed dramatically in recent years And also speak to whether it's creating greater inequity in the college admissions process.
Yeah, so two things have happened. Really, since the Great Recession, early decision has taken off, especially among the more selectives. Because early decision is a binding commitment. You apply in November, you find out in December. And colleges love it because it really fills a segment of their class and increasingly, you know, 50, 60% of their class in some cases early. And that gives them guarantees of who's going to be there. And you don't, from the family perspective, you don't get to compare financial aid offers. And what happened then is when some colleges went more into early decision, it started to have effect further downstream because those are students now that didn't go to those downstream colleges. So those colleges further downstream in the rankings, for example, they started to lean in more into early decision. And then you had all these other colleges move more into early action. You know, Clemson last year started early action and a bunch of other big public started early action, largely because students, for two reasons. One is they were getting so many applicants, they didn't have enough time to review them all. And students will inevitably wait until the last minute to file their application, right? So they just wanted applications earlier. And second, they were starting to lose out to other early action schools or early decision, because now it seems everybody just wants a decision somewhere in the fall or winter of their senior year. I know I didn't find out I'd gotten to college, I think, until February or March, and it was kind of normal, and who cares, right? I'm enjoying senior year. But now it seems like we need to know early. It's like that instant gratification of an acceptance. We may not end up going to that early action place because early action, unlike early decision, is not binding, but we know it. And that's good for families, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly relieves some of the stress of the uncertainty, right? The stress of uncertainty of waiting and not knowing or not knowing if you've gotten in anywhere.
I guess, can I push back a little bit on that?
Because sure.
I think if your list is balanced, like there is a lot of uncertainty in college admissions. I get that. But if you go into this process knowing kind of who you are as a student, if you as a family know kind of what you want out of the college search process and how much money you're willing to spend, and then there's enough information out there along with the counselors that you have to really come up with a balanced list. By the end of March, when you know most decisions will have been made, you're going to have a couple of acceptances in hand, even if, by the way, you never applied early, that are probably going to be pretty good choices for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sometimes true. I think having watched two kids go through the college process already, I think, and you speak to this in the book, there are a lot of, I don't know if it's surprises, but the kids who one would imagine might get in are now no longer getting in. Maybe they're getting waitlisted. Maybe they're getting deferred. Maybe they're getting flat out rejected. But it almost feels like, and Jeff, you can speak to whether this is true, it almost feels like from year to year, the landscape of admissions in the more selective schools and also the schools downstream from there can change from not on a dime, but within a couple of years, there's dramatic shifts. Now, I'm one person in one community speaking to other people in similar communities within my geography. So you could certainly argue this is not a fair sampling, but it feels like things are changing so quickly. And I don't know if you agree with that or that's just perception.
Well, it is perception. And remember, the thing about admissions is you kind of go through it once, right? Well, you might go through it multiple times with multiple kids, but it's not something you buy every year or every couple of years. You're going to go through it once. So your perceptions are really formed kind of in the moment. It's
right.
It's fascinating to me among even my friends, right, who have known for years what I've done, now suddenly want to talk to me about college admissions because they have like a sophomore and junior in high school. Like 4 years ago, forget it. They weren't as interested.
You were
right?
never invited to dinner. Yeah, I was never invited.
Well, now I'm not even invited to dinner because they don't like the reality check I like to tell them, right? So I get disinvited a lot from things because, you know, people don't want to hear this idea of have some reach schools.
Yeah.
Have some schools you can, like, everybody wants those super selective schools that everybody else wants. And they don't like when I tell them, not everyone's going to get in. I know your kid is really special, right? So are hundreds and thousands and millions of other kids out there, right? So Has it gotten crazier and less predictive? Yes. And I think a little bit of it is because of the earlier portion of the admissions process. So early action is you're going to get a decision in January. Now, a decision might be a deferral. And that's what I think is surprising people. Mm-hmm. Because what ends up happening is if you apply early action, you think, well, I'm going to get accepted or I'm going to get denied. But what ends up happening now is a lot of schools are just deferring them to regular decision, largely because they've gotten so many early applicants, they can't even get through them all. And second, they don't really know who's serious, because at the end of the day, yield matters to them, right? It's not who they accept, it's who actually accepts their acceptance. And so they're unsure that all these early applicants are really that interested in them. And so they like to defer them to kind of string them along a little bit. And then they'll see, well, are these kids really interested? Are they going to continue to engage with us? And then by the time regular decision comes around, we could really make a decision on who they are. And so I think that is surprising people, because they're like, wow, I was deferred from Clemson. I was deferred from Florida State. I was deferred from, you know, places that I thought I could have gotten into. That's what I'm hearing a lot from parents today, particularly.
I'd love to drill down on this numbers situation. I'm going to call it a situation. You wrote an editorial a couple of years ago that took me from interested reader to complete rabid fan, because you broke down what was going on with the numbers. And I'm going to botch what you did because I'm going to oversimplify it. But basically, you said more kids are applying to more schools, and they're applying to more schools early as well, partly driven by all of what you're describing now. So we have this catastrophe because the schools literally don't have enough people to even begin to read and process these applications. And so while there's a responsibility in terms of the applier and understanding your responsibility and how you play this game, and it does feel like a game.
It is a game. And by the way, there's one team that has all the stars, and there's one team that has the scrubs and is always playing defense. And I think you could guess who's who.
It's a rough game. And you laid out some solutions that the schools could engage in that were amazing to me. I'm going to summarize them the way I understood them, and I would love to hear sort of where your thinking has evolved to now. One thing you said is the school should actually say who they're looking for. That one of the reasons so many kids apply to so many schools is the schools aren't entirely clear on who can get in. And there are a lot of good reasons, I would imagine, for that. Like, the schools are looking for these kids who have not been given opportunity, and they want to have a wider berth so that they can bring in all these applicants, so that they can maybe get kids in who wouldn't necessarily fit a certain mold. And yet, at the end of the day, when you look at schools who have 10 times the number of applicants that they had a generation ago, and they're not even reading the applications, that's a problem. And then you went on to say, there's a place for even staggering the application process where, am I getting this right?
Yeah, and I actually like this idea the most, but go on.
I'm obsessed with this idea. So the way I understood your suggestion was, schools, you say who you're looking for, give criteria, whatever those criteria are, then students, send in basically page one of your Common App, like a demographic sheet. Say who you are in the simplest terms, and then schools, if this is a kid whose application you are going to read, send the essay questions to that kid and let them proceed. Has your thinking on this evolved as the numbers have grown more and more and more over the past couple of years?
It has. I'm laughing because not necessarily in the best way, because I've now started to think, even if we were to put this into place, it may not work. For one, let's talk about the student side of this. Even if schools were very specific about what they wanted, which they never will be, by the way, because they want everything. But even if they were, just like I know the statistics, I'm playing the Powerball. You know, whenever the Powerball gets really big, what do? I go and buy that ticket because I think I could be the one. And that's exactly what I think a lot of students and parents think, right? They don't want me to tell them, as I'm about to in my next book, like, think bigger, right? Think selective, but think about all these other colleges, because everybody wants to apply to those set of dream schools, whatever they might be. Even, by the way, if they don't feel like they meet the criteria, because you never know. You never know. And these are really smart people doing this. So that's one problem with this thinking. On the iterative process, colleges will say, because I like this idea, where basically you submit some stuff, you get over the first bar, and then you submit the next part, right? Makes sense.
It's like med school application.
It's like med school. It's a little bit of like, are you interested in me? Am I interested in you? It's a little bit like dating, right? Like, okay, like we go on to the second date. We go on to the third date. Then eventually we'll get married, right? Like instead of just like trying to figure, like having a, it's almost like dating where you have like a room full of people and you have to pick somebody out right then and there. What I think colleges will say is, well, we have this holistic process, right? And I saw this when I was embedded in these colleges and we're looking at a bunch of different things. So we can't just see one aspect of a student to know if they're going to get over that bar. That's what they're going to say. Now, could they? Yes, I believe they could, but they're going to fight back on any proposal that limits the amount of information that they're going to get at the very beginning.
Jeff, why do you think those schools let you embed?
Great question. I think they did because, and then I'll tell you what I just tried to do recently. I think they did because they trust their system. Mm. Remember, this was 2018, 2019. So it was before the pandemic. It was before the widespread introduction of test optional. It was before, even though the UNC and Harvard affirmative action cases were coming through, it was before that. And all three of the schools, because remember, 21 said no to me. I approached 24 colleges and universities, and these three were the only ones who said yes. All three of them had admissions teams that had been there for a while, including the admissions dean. I just think they felt confident that I would see something that worked well.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting is last fall, I approached about a dozen or so institutions for a story that I was going to work on about how the admissions process has changed. And they all said no. Mm. And by the way, they have proof now that I could actually do this and I could tell the story, right, in the book. But they said no because now they have less confidence, I believe, in their system. I didn't approach the same schools, by the way, but they have less confidence in their system because test optional. Mm-hmm. Do we accept scores? Don't we accept scores? And this is the first year where they are not allowed to use race and ethnicity in admissions as part of the Supreme Court decision last year. And they told me they're kind of flying blind right now. They're trying to figure things out and they didn't want somebody there observing.
So how do you imagine the Supreme Court case has already affected admissions and will affect admissions in the future?
It's TBD, I think, because we really don't know yet. We know a couple of things. One of the reasons why colleges and universities, especially selective, because that's really where this matters, right? Where seats are scarce and they have a lot of applicants. Those colleges want all the apps they're getting, right? Like everybody talks about, oh, application inflation's terrible, right? They actually want now, especially since they can't use race and ethnicity in admissions, they want as wide of a net that they could draw as many applicants as they can at the very top of that funnel, because at the very bottom, they want to yield enough of a diverse class. So they want to keep that number of applicants. Second, we do know from the Common App numbers so far that the number of Black and Hispanic applicants are up, at least identifying, I should say, as Black and Hispanic are up at selective colleges. White applicants are down. Asian applicants are about even. What's interesting is the number of unknowns are way up. Again, that's actually a growing number with the Common App, where people just refuse to answer that question. Now, the Common App is still collecting that information. The colleges are not downloading it and the colleges are not seeing it. And that's, so we won't really know until enrollment season is over, which is essentially this summer, this fall, how the class actually shakes out in terms of actual numbers, in terms of diversity.
How much is that difference demographic versus just choice of self-identifying?
I think it's a choice of self-identifying. I think it's a choice of self-identifying. I think everyone was trying to figure out, particularly this year, how to game the system, right? You saw every article out there like, well, you have to talk about your identity in your essay, right? Like you have to figure out other ways to tell them who you are. So I think that was just a way of people to not identify in some cases who they are.
And there have been a series of articles out recently about how the test optional status hurts certain populations. Can you talk a little bit about that in the context of the Supreme Court decision and what you think is going to happen?
Yeah, so I think we're going to, even though The University of Texas just recently announced they're going back to the test, as did, you know, Yale and Dartmouth. And so I think, though, we're going to be in a test optional world for quite some time. You know, I have a sixth and eighth grader at home. I think that they will probably be in as much of a test optional world by the time they go to college as we are today. And why is that? Because it gives colleges maximum flexibility. It's very annoying to the parent and the student and the applicant, no doubt about it, right? Like, do I take a test? My suggestion is yes, at least get a score so you know where you stand. But then I might have 10, 12 schools. Do I send them to some, not others? Yes, there's a strategy behind that. And then you're sitting there every day trying to figure out, do I send it or not? So it just increases, by the way, the anxiety that we've been talking to. Meanwhile, on the college side, it gives them great flexibility because now, if there's a student they really mm-hmm. want to take, they could take that student if they don't have a test score, because now it's not going to ding them mm-hmm. in the average test score, which really matters to these colleges for various reasons, right? So now it's very easy to take that student they really wanted who previously might have had a 1200, and that would have really impacted their 1500 average SAT score. And so they would have rejected that student in the past.
But the colleges have created a small problem for themselves in being test optional, which is that the kids who submit their scores are submitting high scores.
Yes.
They're not submitting scores below the median in general. And so what has happened, the average reported score is much, much higher now for a lot of schools. And so you have this cycle that has begun where students are going onto college websites and they are seeing an average score, which is very high, and I would argue very high across the board for a lot of different colleges. And that's intimidating because those are the kids who are submitting their scores who are doing the math and they're above average. And so how does that correct? Because it's not a real number.
Well, I think it corrects if colleges were to give us more information rather than less. So what I want to know among those average scores, like who submitted, who didn't? Because at the end of the day, I want to know for an applicant like me, I'm in this high school, mm-hmm. I have this type of GPA, I want to major in this, because that's the big thing here, by the way. If you really ask admissions officers who's submitting and who's not, if you're applying to a STEM major or you're applying to business, 90%+ at these selective schools are submitting scores. And by the way, they're really the kids getting in. If you're in the humanities or other majors, more likely you're not submitting a score and you're getting in, right? So that's the unevenness of this. And if we had that information by major, by gender, by race and ethnicity, by geography, like by all these different factors, then I could sit in my house at my high school and say, okay, I'm this type of applicant and here's where I potentially stand, or here's what the average is. So give me bands of scores by that. But when they just give us an average for everybody, it's not really that helpful.
Jeff, you talk about in the book this concept of certain schools as buyers and certain schools as sellers. And it's a really interesting way of categorizing schools and also applicants. Can you talk about what you mean by that and how it impacts our understanding of the college landscape?
Yeah, so I came up with this concept while reporting the book, because what I ended up seeing were that many of the families I was with, or many of the schools I was with, they might qualify for financial aid, need-based financial aid, but probably not. They made just enough, but they didn't make enough to really easily pay for, you know, full freight for 4 years, right? You know, at a private, you're talking 70, 80, 90,000, depending on where you go, times four, right? So, and what would happen is, though, students would apply to these set of colleges because they were selective. And then they wouldn't get much aid. And they would come into their counselor all in tears. And they would say, I got into fill in the blank great college, but I didn't get any aid because, again, they were above the income cutoffs, but their parents were really unwilling to pay that money. And so those are the sellers, as I describe them in higher ed. There's not many of them, maybe 50, 60 schools. They are inundated with applications and they only have to give away financial aid to those who really need it. And they're pretty generous with that need-based financial aid, but they don't give out any non-need-based aid, merit aid. Meanwhile, there are hundreds, thousands of schools that are buyers. They literally have to give a discount to a student, just like Macy's or Kohl's puts out coupons to get you in the store to buy other things, the same thing that colleges are doing. And I think it's really important for parents and students to understand this during the admissions process, because what ends up happening is if you only apply to sellers, You will then find out in April you got into some of those places, but by the way, you're not going to get any financial aid. While if you apply to a mix of sellers and buyers, you at least have options to say, this is how much we really do want to spend. And by the way, this school who's a buyer is offering us a decent amount of money. And by the way, these schools are pretty good. I mean, the term buyers and sellers has nothing to do with the educational quality of the school. It has more to do how they approach financial aid. And I think that most parents and students look at the sticker price of a college. They think that's what we're actually going to pay unless we get need-based aid. And what they don't realize is that there's all of this merit-based, basically discounts that are out there. But you really need to know that during the admissions process, not at the very end while you're waiting for financial aid.
But then that begs the question about the value of the education in general, because as the sticker price goes up, even if it's a discounted sticker price, what you're going to pay is higher, right? It's a lot of money. And managing debt is a real challenge, I would say, to use a nice word, for kids who at 22, 23 are entering the workforce and really feel strangled by debt and making a lot of life choices based upon college debt. So as you've been doing this work, is college increasingly less worth it?
No, I don't think it is. Are some colleges less worth it? Yes. The bachelor's degree itself is very worth it. And I've done a lot of research just in the last year with the Burning Glass Institute on how much more a bachelor's degree makes over the course of even the first 10 years after college than a high school diploma. The other thing that we don't often talk about, by the way, is that a college diploma gives you options. It gives you mobility. In other words, you could move in and out of companies more easily. You can move up and get promotions more easily with a college degree. The problem, though, is how much money are you putting in to get that college degree? Yes, if you are paying full freight, you have to, as a student, take out loans. Parents have to take out Parent Plus loans. Maybe you have to take out private loans in order to afford that undergraduate degree. And I want to be key on that term undergraduate. That is not worth it, right? But again, if you're doing this process right, you should have at the end of March of your senior year or beginning of April, you should have probably a couple of good choices for schools. You're probably going to have a couple of good financial aid packages. And there will probably be one or two places that are a good financial fit, academic fit, and social fit. And so you're not going to go deep into debt, where again, I think you go into deep debt where people just make bad choices at the undergraduate level. The other thing about debt is that a lot of the education debt we talk about is at the graduate level, where, you know, students and parents even then are taking out a lot of loans because there's not as much discounting going on at the graduate level. But at the undergraduate level, the bachelor's degree, I still think is worth it. Question though is, don't overpay for it. Don't go into too much debt. And what do I mean by too much debt? To me, a good rule of thumb is, you know, what's the average starting salary in your field? You know, if it's 40,000, try not to be over 40,000 for undergraduate debt. And by the way, that includes parent debt as well. So, you know, maybe the student takes on 5,000 a year and the parent takes on $5,000 a year. That seems pretty reasonable to me. But if you have to basically take on debt for almost the entire amount, that should be sending off alarm bells, in my opinion.
And Jeff, do you feel that way, even though more recently employers are removing the bachelor degree requirement in job applications? Do you think that's going to impact things?
Great question. At all? Because if you look at data from LinkedIn, if you looked at data even from Burning Glass, did a recent survey on actual degreeless hiring. So what's really popular is we're removing the degree requirements from the job ad, but who's actually getting hired? A very small percentage of people without degrees.
Okay.
So there's a big disconnect by that. And I like to really break that myth a little bit, because who's hiring people? It's usually people with college degrees. Even if you think your degree might've been worthless, you're like, well, I'm not going to be the schmuck that hires like somebody, you know, without a degree, because I think at the very least, it's some sort of signal that this person could do the job or something like that. So we see a lot of ads without degrees, but we do not see a lot of hiring without degrees.
I just want to put a finer point on something you've talked about today, but I want to drill down on it, which is the concept of college as a scarce commodity. And your perspective is that that's an incorrect assumption, and people really get that wrong. And if we open our minds a bit to the vaster universe of higher education possibilities, A, people won't go into so much debt or put themselves under such financial pressure. And also we can perceive the college process as a very different process than we currently do. Can you speak to the fact that it's not a scarce commodity and why that is and how we can kind of shift our thinking?
Yeah. What is a scarce commodity are the wealthiest, most selective schools by definition, I guess they're scarce, right? The stat I always like to use is there's, by some count, there's like 3,000-4,000 colleges in the US, right? If you take out all the special purpose ones, the ministries and the music and art schools, the two-year colleges, and then you're left with a universe of four-year colleges, for example. And then you take out the four-year colleges that are really tiny. They're under 1,000 students. You're still talking about a universe of about 1,000 colleges. Four-year colleges, more than 1,000 students. That's a lot of colleges, right? Because when you think about it, probably everybody in your community is talking about the same 20 or 30 or 40, or you're looking at the US News and World Report rankings and you're only looking at the top 100. If you're only looking at that group, yes, very scarce, largely because they're very tiny, right? I like to always tell the stat about Canada. So the top four universities in Canada, meaning by the rankings, right? University of Toronto, McGill, University of British Columbia, right? They enroll something like 140,000 undergraduates combined. They're top universities, rankings-wise, but they also are big. In the U.S. News and World Report National University Rankings, you would have to go all the way down to number 18. In other words, you would have to go to 18 colleges and universities to get that number of undergraduates. That's why it's scarce, because the top colleges, quote-unquote top, I put those in quotes because the rankings are a whole nother probably podcast in itself. That's why we think they're scarce. There are plenty of colleges out there, plenty of seats for students. And I know what parents are going to say, well, how do I really know if they're any good, or how much should I spend on those colleges? Which, by the way, my next book will answer. But there are many more than we tend to think there are in the US.
We are absolutely asking back to talk about rankings because it's a fascinating piece of this. But I want to land with a question that's related to rankings. It's sort of a rankings meets branding question. You spend time in Who Gets In and Why talking about Northeastern in particular and its quest to improve its rank. And you do it in this incredibly non-judgmental way. Like it was a goal and they reached their goal and it was incredible. And yet underneath it, as I was reading, I was struck by the sort of branding of it all that we're all vulnerable to, and this idea of who is the best and what is the best and what you should want and why and numeric ratings and all of it. And we're all vulnerable to that. That's why advertising is successful. I mean, it's an interesting lens that you put on that one piece of this. And I wonder if where we can land is some advice to the adults in kids' lives, whether they're parents, grandparents who have a lot to say, mentors, coaches, any adult who loves a child. What advice do you have for them in terms of pulling the lens back away from the branding and away from sort of all the noise? And how do you begin to help a kid, and I guess yourself as the adult, rethink all of this?
I think we have to put some perspective on just how long our lives are, and that this is an important journey, that journey to college. And it's the biggest probably decision that an 18-year-old and their family is going to make. But college is just one kind of stopping point in your life. You know, if any parent out there thinks about all the different moments in their life where they had to make big decisions, certainly where to go to college probably was one of them, but it's not the only one, it's certainly not the last one. And so is it that you're going to meet some of the people that will become perhaps your life partners, right? Your lifelong friends. You're definitely going to meet people who probably help you into those first jobs. Maybe they'll help you for the rest of your life. I'm not saying that college doesn't have an impact on who you become, but it maybe has more of an impact on who you become in those first couple of years, but not for the rest of your life. I think it's obviously going to be part of your DNA forever, but it's not the largest part of your DNA when you're 40 or 50 or 60 or 70. And I think, especially given what's happening in the job market, in careers, who knows what the impact of AI is going to have on our lives, you mentioned the grandparents. I think that most grandparents out there, they might have been the first in their family to go to college. And there's no doubt about it, that probably had a huge impact. I sometimes vacation on the Jersey Shore, and I'm always fascinated, you know, walking the beach in the morning, you know, and there's older people wearing college t-shirts. And I often think, oh, they must be sending their grandkids there. And so sometimes I'll ask them, you know, and no, that they went there, right? Like, I'm thinking, wow, this is a product you consumed like 50 years ago, and you're still advertising it because it had such a big impact on their life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because they were the first in their family to go, and it changed the trajectory of their life. I'm not saying that doesn't happen today, but it is one of many of those changes in your trajectory throughout life. And I think that's the perspective we need. And I know that's a lot easier said than done, as we're looking at our own kids and our own lives in a prospective way, right? We don't know what they're going to be like when they're 40 or 50. But let's think about our own lives and the impact of college had on our lives and try to put that into perspective.
I mean,
Jeff, we have like 4 million more questions to ask you, but we will pause here and just wait for the next opportunity to have you on. And people should read Jeff's book, Who Gets In and Why. It will give you like real insight into many aspects of the college process and some perspective, which I think we're all in need of. And somehow he does it without, as Cara said earlier, a lot of judgment and a lot of self-righteousness. He is truly a reporter, which seems to be less and less true reality in our world, but it is true reporting and incredibly helpful and insightful. So Jeff, thank you for joining us, and we will schedule your return now for what, when does the next book come out?
Probably in August, September of 2025.
Oh, you're perfect. Coming back before yeah. that.
Perfect. We'll send you the calendar invite now. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
We absolutely love hearing your feedback and getting all your questions. So anytime you want to be in touch, email us at thepubertypodcast@gmail.com. If you're looking for great puberty products like the Oom shorts or the Oom socks or the Oom bra, you get the theme there, go to myoomla.com. If you want more content, you love what we do on the Puberty Podcast, and you want to have us come speak or learn more about our book or subscribe to our amazing newsletter, The Awkward Roller Coaster, go to orderofmagnitude.co. Remember, it's .co because we don't have enough money to buy .com. Yet.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.